You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Remember a couple of days ago, we were talking about how when companies buy back their stock, it increases the dividend that they pay out, and if their executives are paid in addition to a regular paycheck, only $2 million of which is tax-deductible to the corporation. If they're paid by being given stock, which they can then later convert to cash, they only pay 20%, maximum 20% income tax on that, capital gains, plus they get dividends while they're holding the stock. So Boeing is doing this. They're the $10 billion buyout, raising their dividend, making their stockholders, and in particular their executives richer. What are they doing for their workers? Are their workers getting richer? Let's check in with Connie Kelleher. She's the communications director of the International Association of Machinists, IAM751.org. Connie, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Am I pronouncing your last name right?
Yes.
Great. We have been talking on the show over the last couple of days about what's going on with Boeing in Washington State with the, what is it, the 777?
777X, their new airplane derivative.
Yeah, that they've been shopping around, and I guess it was it Nebraska or Montana? Some state came up with $1.7 billion and said, we'll give you that if you'll come here and stuff like that.
Right. 22 states have actually put in a bid for the work, including Washington State, who gave the biggest tax incentives in history. We're offering $8.7 billion.
Whoa.
To keep the work here.
This is crazy. You know, Bernie Sanders proposed that any state that competes with tax dollars against another state within the United States should lose all their federal highway funds. This race to the bottom is just nuts. But anyhow, what is the current state of where the machinists are with regard to the company and all that kind of thing?
Well, the first thing, we actually have a legal contract in place with Boeing through September of 2016, which people kind of lose that in the conversation. But because Boeing has this carrot to dangle of the new airplane derivative, they were hoping to get as much out of everybody as they could. So they were playing states against each other and decided they wanted to try to wring more out of their workforce here that, you know, generates those huge profits that they currently get.
Right.
So they came to the union to negotiate. Well, they say negotiate. We say it was more or less an ultimatum. And never in our history have we ever had so much on the line in the one vote that we took in mid-November, that it was one of the most destructive, divisive proposals we've ever seen. And if we accepted it, we would have given up wages, benefits, and pensions that were established long before any of us got here, with people before us who struck on the line. So basically, we were faced with a decision, a choice to destroy everything that we'd built in order to save Boeing from making a decision that puts the future of the company and all of its employees, union and non-union alike, and the stockholders at risk. And, you know, our members said if the company chooses that path of destruction, they're responsible for that. That's on them. It's not on us. That the price they were asking for from us was just simply too high. The number one thing they said they needed from the machinist union was labor stability, and we were willing to explore that with them, but not at the price that, had we accepted what they were trying to force on us, our ability to negotiate anything positive and reasonable would have been lost forever. I mean, I'm very proud of our membership. They stood together, and they were vilified in the media. We had politicians weighing in, and the members looked at everything and said, no, is it a risk that the company may move that work? Yeah, those threats are very real, but we know that the very best place to build those airplanes is right here, and we're the reason, you know, Boeing Commercial Airplanes made $14 billion in revenue in the last quarter.
Whoa.
I mean, it's just only the federal government has more zeros tacked on to anything than Boeing does.
That's amazing. It's really amazing. And yet, ever since the beginning of the Reagan presidency, when Reagan installed the first openly hostile to labor Secretary of Labor in the history of the Department of Labor, and began the you know, this aggressive war on unions. You could date the beginning of the war on unions back to 1947 with the passage of Taft-Hartley and the creation of so-called right-to-work-for-less states. But ever since the Reagan administration, it's been a tough one for unions. When GM went through this managed bankruptcy during the Obama administration, of all things, the UAW ended up saying that, okay, new hires are going to come in at $14 an hour instead of the 20-some-odd dollars that that our current workers are making. That goes way beyond a give back. I mean, that's like, you know, okay, we're gonna go to a McDonald's economy here.
And that's exactly where Boeing's trying to put us, that actually our hire-in rates have moved once since 1992. And the proposal that Boeing, that our members voted down, would have put our members in progression for 20 years or more. They'd be chasing a maximum pay rate their entire career.
Yeah.
Where right now it's, you know, 6 years and you get to the maximum.
But
your job by the time you've done it for 6 years.
Sure. But the flip side of that is that Boeing can move that to South Carolina or, you know, any of these other right-to-work-for-less states, and then you've got nothing. How do you deal with that? How is this playing out, Connie? We have about 2 minutes left here.
Okay. Well, you know, the skills and efficiencies that our members bring is the value to Boeing, that their customers the airline customers have spoke really loud and clear. They don't want another debacle like the 787 disaster where it was delivered 3 years late. So the place that has the least amount of risk is right here in Washington State, because it's existing lines, you've got generations of workers. So we want them to put it here because it makes the most business sense. Actually, South Carolina and us, we're about $1 an hour difference in the higher in rate. But it's the skills and knowledge that are here. When we were fighting to get the Air Force tanker program, the skills and expertise at our Everett factory were able to shave 25% off of the cost off that airplane.
Wow.
Now, our labor and benefits are less than 5% of the airplane cost. The only way you could get those kind of efficiencies is a skilled workforce. I mean, if we worked for free, you could have only shaved 5% off, but the skills and expertise were able to shave 25% off. I mean, we just encourage Boeing, why don't you harness the skills and knowledge that you have on your payroll?
So how is this playing out right now?
Right now, Boeing continues to try to pressure us to accept less. They came back to the table and made minimal changes and tried to force us into a vote. They actually said there's only an offer on the table if the union would not only recommend acceptance, but go out and sell it. And they just made minor tweaks. They added another $5,000 bonus 6 years from now, when we'd normally be bargaining 2 years from now, and gave $500 more on dental.
So you guys aren't that. Now, one of the criticisms is that the, quote, union bosses, end quote, aren't letting the membership vote on that. Is that true?
That is true. That, you know, our members, the majority of them, the vast majority of them, are telling us that no means no, that we have a contract in place through 2016, and we're not going to vote every offer that Boeing tweaks a little bit until they get 50% plus one to get us to destroy everything that we've worked 78 years to build to give us a good middle-class job for the workers here.
Right.
And the people that are calling for a vote, a lot of them are very scared. They're the new hires that haven't been through a traditional bargaining where they see the solidarity and the strength they have when the members all stand together. And frankly, I think Boeing never wants us to go through a traditional bargaining cycle again, because they know that's where we build the solidarity and educate the people that everything you have today is built on a sacrifice somebody who came before you made.
Remarkable. Connie Kelleher. Thank you, Connie. Hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And the website IAM751.org for more information. Thank you, Connie.
Thank you.
Good talk. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 15 minutes past the hour. Nate Sweet, producer with The Big Picture, is on the line with us. And hey, Nate, welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Very good, thank you. And so we're going to open the show with a former NSA official who says we're now either officially in or damn close to a police state.
Yeah, Bill Binney's going to be on the show. Great guest to talk about the, you know, kind of a big week for NSA-related news. Some of that stuff sort of fell out of the news for a while with the shutdown and what have you, but Judge Leon's ruling and the release of the Presidential Review Group's panel recommendations on NSA reform both sort of shot that back up to back into the news this week. So he'll be talking about that, and then we'll get his thoughts, obviously, on how we're moving towards a police state. So great guest to have on that. Really interested to hear what he has to say about whether the panel recommendations are good enough or what we have to do to go farther to reform the surveillance state.
Right. And from that, we're going to segue into a discussion of the Maryland KKK.
Yes, the Maryland KKK is trying to plot Obama's impeachment. And we are trying to get Richard Preston, the Imperial Wizard for the Confederate White Knights, the division of the KKK that's suing Obama or trying to impeach Obama, in the studio for a discussion slash debate. That may not happen, but if it does, it's definitely something your viewers should tune into.
Right.
Won't be something they want to miss. We'll also be joined in the second part of the show by Stephanie Kelton, an economist at University of Missouri, Kansas City, and she'll be talking about quantitative easing and the potential ramifications of it down the road.
Right, and she's one of the top people in the modern monetary theory, right. The MMT movement.
So Steve Keen. Steve Keen's a part of that movement, I believe,
right.
Too, right?
Yeah, he is. Although he's in Australia.
Right.
And then we're going to have a Your Take, My Take live.
Yep. Viewers will call in, ask their questions. Hopefully if people get their if we get the Confederate White Knights on, people can share their thoughts on whether or not Obama is deserving of that impeachment. We welcome those thoughts.
Yeah. That should be entertaining. Geeky science.
Yeah. It's sort of a big geeky science about a bunch of different stories related to evolution. There's new reports that show that that caterpillars are actually changing the way they develop based on climate change, and sewage can actually be a breeding ground for superbugs. So we're getting into a bunch of those stories, a really interesting geeky science that's going to touch a bunch of different new science headlines that have come out this week.
But wait a minute, Nate. The world is only 6,000 years old, and there's no such thing as evolution.
You're sounding like Eric Hovind now.
Yeah. I mean, how is this stuff possible? I mean, this doesn't make any sense. Okay, so that's our geeky science. And then our daily take.
Our daily take is going to be a look at John Podesta made news this week with his comments about Republicans being a part of a Jonestown-like cult. And, you know, Podesta's had to draw back those comments because of their political consequences. But we here at the Big Picture actually think he kind of has a point. So we'll be looking at what makes up the Republican Kool-Aid and getting down into the nitty-gritty of that.
Yeah. It's going to be a good one. It's going to be a really good one. So, Nate Sweet, thank you very much.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you.
Bye.
Nate Sweet with The Big Picture. And it's going to be a good show tonight. And in particular, our Your Take, My Take live, it's going to be fun. The first part of that, we always play video questions. So if you want to submit a video question for that, they always go first. This is where you point your camera at yourself or your phone or your computer or whatever. Click record and then, you know, ask your question into your camera, save that video file, and then email it to us at yourtakemytake@gmail.com. And you may be on Big Picture tonight. We'll be back 20 minutes past. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Okay, cell phones on airplanes. By the way, before I even get into this, you know, Ted Kennedy died of brain cancer, and he was around when these new cell phones, they started out as brick phones and worked their way down to small phones, came along. And there's a lot of speculation that these cell phones produce, you know, they produce radiation in the microwave frequencies. They can cook things. And I remember back in the 90s, I had one of the very first small cell phones. And I actually burned my index finger, my right hand, and my thumb so much that it burned away part of my fingerprint. It actually, you know, flattened the skin out. I mean, it was like getting a callus on your thumb and finger from holding that phone up to my head. God only knows what it did to my brain. Maybe that accounts for the occasional brain fart or something here on the program. So I remember that. And then Louise used to come into the radio studio here with me every day. And over the last month or so, maybe a little longer, last month or so anyway, she's been staying over at the TV studios she's just, you know, her workload has increased enough that just coming in, she just stays there and she just keeps on working. And And to get from the TV studio over to the, we start out the morning at the TV studio, 10 o'clock in the morning, put together both the shows, radio and TV, conference call. And then around, I don't know, 1 o'clock, 1:30, thereabouts, I take the train, the subway, from the TV studio over here to the radio studio where I'm talking to you from right now. It's a three-stop ride on the metro. And then I walk over to the radio studio. And I frequently talk with Louise on the phone. You know, call her up when I walk out the building. It's about a three-block walk over to the train station. And then the train goes through three station stops. And at each station stop, the telephone recovers its signal. And because there's no signal in when the train is in the tunnel. And I've noticed, and I've been wearing this winter coat, and I've been keeping the phone in the right-hand pocket of my winter coat where it's right up against my stomach on the right-hand side. And I noticed last week that I've got like this burn on the skin on my stomach. It's the weirdest thing. You know, it was starting to itch, and then I thought, well, this is like a burn. And I think it's because I'm talking on the phone, and as I'm walking into the subway, I lose the signal with Louise and while I'm talking to her. And the phone is just jacking out the greatest amount of radiation it possibly can as you're losing a signal. And then every time it goes in and out of one of these subway stations, it does the largest burst of radiation it can to try and get the new signal. And I think I cooked myself. I mean, it's totally weird. And so now, the last couple of days, what I've been doing is just putting my phone into airplane mode before I go down underground, and the burn is not getting any worse. It seems to be getting better now, but it's just, if you've ever had an experience like that, or if you think that maybe it's just a coincidence that I just have a patch of skin that suddenly got weird. I don't know. I can't figure it out, but I think that it has to do with phone radiation. That said, one time I was flying, and I had my phone in my sports coat pocket, and we got up to altitude, and I pulled the phone out because I read on my phone when I'm flying, and I listen to music on my phone when I'm flying. Put a pair of noise-canceling headphones on, plug them into my iPhone, and listen to the music that I've got on there while I'm reading on my – I've got a Kindle app, I've got a Nook app, and I've got the – Apple app, and I've bought books from all three different sources. And so, you know, I read. And one time I pulled the phone out, and I looked at it, and I noticed that I had forgotten to put it in airplane mode, and we were at like 30,000 feet flying across the United States. But it could not get a signal. It had given up. It just said no service. So, and, you know, I started out as a broadcast engineer. I studied electrical engineering in college briefly. And I'm an old ham radio operator. I have a fairly above average knowledge of electronics and particularly radio wave stuff, you know, that I got from, you know, when I was 13 years old, I got my general ticket, at that time, the highest amateur radio license you could get, which required not only, as I recall, it was 12 words per minute, 13 words per minute of Morse code, but also a fairly comprehensive electronics test. So my opinion is not uninformed. I don't think it's possible for a cell phone to work on a plane flying at altitude because you're crossing the cell phone towers so fast that it's not possible for the towers, the software in the towers. First of all, I doubt that the signal coming out of the phone is strong enough to go down 6 miles to the ground or 5 miles to the ground. And secondly, even if it could, the software in the towers couldn't hand you off from tower to tower fast enough. You're going 600 miles an hour relative to the ground, or 500 and change. So when we first moved here to Washington, D.C., the AT&T service was so crappy in both the TV studio and the radio studio that AT&T sells these little products called a mini tower. And it's basically a cell phone tower that broadcasts on cell phone frequencies, but you plug it into an internet line, and AT&T charges you for the phone calls that you make on it by the minute, even though you're actually just talking over the internet. But it gives you your own local cell phone tower. So it must be that the airlines are looking at the possibility, some airlines are looking at the possibility of putting these towers in their airplanes so that people can use their cell phones. That's the only thing I can come up with. Or I've noticed that the FCC is talking about texting and emailing on your phone, but not actual phone calls. Or if you're going to do a phone call, it would be like a FaceTime phone call, which happens over the Internet. It doesn't happen over the cell towers because the cell towers are not going to be available. But there's this big debate about whether people should be able to talk on their phones on airplanes, and some airplanes are going to be without and some with, and I'm in the without camp. Although I remember when Delta and then United both introduced in-air telephones that you could use, at least in first class, they had these phones. Actually in coach even, they had one for every three seats. And you swipe your credit card and you can make a call. But it was like $3 a minute, so people basically only use them for emergencies. But it's just, you know, on a plane, you're like stuck with somebody in this little tube. It seems like there should be some place left where there's no conversation going on.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So have you ever been burned by your cell phone? And what do you think about whether people should be able to make calls on phone? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 28 minutes past or before the hour. David in Addison, Illinois, you wanted to talk about phones warming up?
Just listening to your previous segment about the whole cell phone radiation possibly causing heat. I just wanted to clear up some misinformation.
It doesn't cause heat in the phone itself. The phone itself, any heat there would be from the chemical reaction of the battery that's producing the electricity. But if it's in contact with tissue that can absorb radiation, it will produce heat the same way a microwave oven does if you put a piece of turkey into it.
It would, except for that cell phones don't operate at a power level orders of magnitude, like they're orders of magnitude weaker than what's required to heat human tissue a noticeable level.
Well, that's what's being debated. I mean, you've got radiation decays according to the reciprocal of the square law. So every doubling of distance is a tenfold drop in radiation levels. So if you get a phone even a few centimeters away from you, you're dramatically reducing the amount of radiation that you're exposed to. But what if it's right up against your skin for extended periods of time?
Every study that's been done, and there have been several studies that have been done specifically on holding a phone directly up against skin.
Right.
I can't cite them to you right now, but they can't noticeably heat up human tissue. The debate isn't whether or not it heats up human tissue. It's that whether or not the imperceptible heating or the imperceptible transfer of energy is enough to harm human tissue long term. There are two kinds of radiation. There's ionizing, which is gamma and X-rays, and those actually destroy atoms actively.
Of course, yeah. This is all non-ionizing. This is electromagnetic radiation.
Yes. Which again, the only possible adverse effect from that is heating. And if we could determine that heating occurs from the radiation, then we can argue whether or not the effects are extensive. But
right.
The question isn't whether or not the heating occurs. It's because it doesn't. It doesn't occur in any perceptible way. And if you had a phone up to your, if you had 100 phones up to your skin, you wouldn't be able to feed.
So is it possible in your, you seem to have studied this somewhat. Is it possible, the phone physically gets warm. And it could be a defective battery, who knows, or it could just be that it's burning through energy so much. Could it be that long-term low-level heating, just literally from the phone itself, as if it was a little 2-watt electric heater, or 20-watt electric heater? So I don't know what the kind of wattage that the phone can put up. It's actually micro, and the radiation is in microwatts or milliwatts. But if the heat energy, the heat transfer from the battery, forget the radiation, might that be enough to cause skin to react in a negative way?
The argument's definitely there. I mean, if you've ever heard of people who keep laptops on their lap, they can get cracking of their skin and skin damage on their lap. So I'm sure that if you kept your phone up to your head daily for hours on end, there might be.
Well, with this winter coat, I've been sticking it in the right hand pocket, and it puts the phone. I mean, it's got a layer of coat, which is a fairly lightweight coat actually on the inside. It's got a layer of coat and a shirt between it and my skin. So there's probably, you know, a centimeter or so of space. But it's right up against the skin. It might just be a coincidence.
It's more than likely what it is. You were talking about going in and out of tunnels, but what's more than likely happening is because the signal drops, the phone's processor starts working overtime to try and connect to whatever available.
Yeah, it's not the processor, it's the transmitter, but yeah.
And it's draining the battery. It's draining the battery at a much
higher rate. and thus generating more heat from the electrochemical reaction of producing electricity. Yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. David, thanks a lot for the call. Appreciate it. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul.
Hey, Tom. My new terminology for corporations like Boeing is our corporation panhandlers.
Well, this is what's going on. It's not just Boeing. I mean, this the new business model in America is, you know, rob the workers and enrich the CEOs, because working people are motivated by unemployment and poverty and sickness, and rich people are motivated by tax cuts.
Well, and they're standing on the street corners of every other state and saying, "Give us money." Now, I they want money from everybody. As a matter of fact, they're aggressive panhandlers.
Mm.
You know, the state of Washington has passed a tax package for almost $9 billion, which is, on an annual basis, about three-quarters of the education, the K-12 education budget. That's a chunk of change right there. And now they don't want to pay the workers either.
Right.
So you have to give them a lot of money for them to say that they like. And it's becoming every time they have a new model of airplane. And we went through this with the 787. It's like
They moved to some other state, didn't they?
Well, no, actually, when they took the production of the 787 to South Carolina, those were back orders. That was the ineptitude of the administrative management to be able to actually get their airplanes out on time.
Right.
So the 787 production in South Carolina is those are all back orders. Those aren't new orders.
Weren't they making some like tail assembly or wing assembly or something in China too?
Possibly. They probably make things all over the world.
Yeah, I remember a story going by about something like that, but it might have been just a piece of it or something.
But
in any case, the
take here in the media is that it's all the union's fault, and you know, and nobody see what just floors me is that nobody seems to get it. So where do you think where does that $9 billion in tax revenue is going to come from?
Mm-hmm.
It's going to come from us.
Right.
Of course, the other side is, well, if there's nothing to tax, if Boeing leaves, then you don't have the money anyway. Well, my question is there a cadre of airplane machinists standing by in every other state in the union ready to manufacture an airplane? You know, it's getting to be, they're just like sports franchises. Build us a stadium or we're leaving.
Right.
And
yeah.
Honestly, I don't think, and then the other thing was that, people are saying, well, you know, it would be the machinists' fault and their selfishness if the economy in Washington State, here in Western Washington, really went down because of Boeing leaving. But they don't seem to understand that if you pay the workers, doesn't that contribute to the economy, because those people are going to spend their money here.
Yeah. Well, see, that's, you're talking about rational old school economics, not the supply side economics, that if you can make the CEOs rich, and the stockholders rich, you know, it doesn't matter about the workers, because we don't care about the workers anymore, actually. You know, we can move, as the current president of GE said, Jack Welch said, you know, if he could put his manufacturing facilities in a barge and just move it from country to country as living standards and labor costs went up, move it to the next cheapest country. He would do that. That's how these guys are thinking. Paul, thanks a lot for the call. Mark in Soap Lake, Washington, you are anti-union on this?
No, I'm not anti-union. I've been in a few unions. I used to be in the Carpenters Union until Reagan let all the guest workers in the U.S. But when I worked for Boeing, I was on strike for them on three different strikes. Last strike I was on, my shop steward suddenly became a supervisor for management. And then when the strike was over, he became a shop steward again. That kind of tells me that the union is a little bit corrupt.
Well, here's the thing. Unions are democracies. If 51% of the members don't want that management, that leadership in the union, they can vote them out. It's that simple.
Now, I complained about the shop steward, and I was basically told to shut up.
Yeah. Well, at least you had a union. I mean, if you complain within a workplace, you can simply be fired. Within a union, you know, you have the right to complain, and you have the right to get 51% of your fellow workers and replace all of management or any part of management that you want. That's you know, unions are democracies, small d democracies. David in Chicago. Hey, David, you got a cell phone thought?
Yeah, yes, actually. I used to work in cell phones, and actually the burn you're probably getting is probably because the back of the phone is facing towards you.
Mm-hmm.
And the back of the phone is where the antenna is in every cell phone. It's always on the back.
Hmm.
That's why in your manual, if you read your manual, in the back toward the warning section, there's actually a section on the radiation that it produces, and it tells you to face the back of your phone away from your body.
Hmm.
That's why most belt clips and such like that you get always face the phone away from your body.
Well, that's interesting.
Because the antenna is where all the radiation is.
Yeah, the way that I do it is I wear a pair of earbuds in my ears, and then I just stick the phone in my pocket, you know, and the pocket, of course, is right up against that skin there.
You might want to try turning it around and make sure the face of the, the touch screen or whatever you have facing towards your body.
Yeah.
And that'll actually take care of that problem.
That's interesting. I'll try that. What I'm doing right now is just, you know, because going through those tunnels, I know is producing these bursts of radiation, and or heating from the battery, your choice. I mean, either one makes sense to me that it's causing this. I'm just flipping the phone into airplane mode before I start going down the stairway, at the train station, you know, before I go underground, before I start losing the signal, because, you know, basically a cell phone, you know, they don't produce that much radiation. I mean, even when you're talking on the phone, but when they're idle, they're, you know, it's every few minutes or so it'll send out a "I'm here, are you still there?" you know, interrogation of the tower.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're talking, it's, you know, it's continuously transmitting, and then when you go into one of the, you know, when this is, I've had so many conversations with Louise where the phone gets dropped, you know, the call gets dropped because I'm going underground and I'm like hitting that dead zone, and, you know, it's just, that's when all this started. It's like, I got to stop talking to my wife while I'm commuting, as it were. David, thank you for the information. I appreciate it. I'm going to have to read the manual here. There's an acronym that has something to do with that, but we'll leave that out of here. It's 15 minutes before the hour. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
That's interesting. I've got more calls on phone radiation than I do on whether you should be able to talk on a phone in an airplane. I expected it to be the other way around. We'll be right back. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. Harold in Upland, Indiana, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Harold, what's up?
Yeah, well, Merry Christmas, Tom.
Well, Merry Christmas to you, Harold.
New Year and all that good stuff. Well, I wanted to talk to you about FDR.
Okay.
I enjoyed you bringing up his speeches on the news there.
Mm-hmm.
I lived through that. I was 10 years old when FDR took office.
Whoa.
And then when I got out of high school in 39, I joined the 3Cs. And 15 company, 1585, Mom got $22 a month, and I got $8, you know. We got our clothes and good food. I gained weight when I went in there.
Wow.
But
this is the Civilian Conservation Corps, right?
Yes, Civilian Conservation Corps, yes. I was in it for a year and a half until the beginning of 41.
Uh-huh.
Something you might not know, I can tell you. You know the Sky High Drive down to through Virginia?
Mm-hmm.
The CC boys built that.
Whoa.
And Mr. President Roosevelt came out and had dinner with him one time. I remember that was in the Franklin Diggins Company magazine.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I showed pictures of him. He was eating with the boys, and they had a good visit. But that road, the Sky High Drive, only cost the government $600 a mile.
Wow.
Yeah, the CC boys drove with the bulldozers, the direct lines. I'd done the same thing right here in the central Indiana when I was in. I went to school every night. They had the educational deal. I learned to survey. Oh, yeah. That was the best thing going right there to get the young guys off the street and help the families. You know,
Right. And they paid your family as what? Now, with the CCC, you actually left home. It was almost like joining the Army, right?
Well, no. We didn't join the Army. You joined the CCC.
No, I mean, the metaphor is like you left home and you lived in the CCC camps, the way that if you join the Army, you go and live in an Army base.
Barracks. There was 100 of us guys in each barracks. We had our regular stuff, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's remarkable. I think, you know, and this was the government as the employer of last resort. Capitalism had failed. Business wasn't hiring people. So FDR said, fine, we'll put people to work. I think
that
we should be doing this again.
For these young guys out here.
Yeah, I think we should be doing it right now. I think we should be doing it again. There's a lot
good,
of...
Good, good. I can't understand. They talked about this Peace Corps. Well, the Peace Corps several years ago, and it wasn't anything like our CCCs. We built... the shelters in the parks,
right.
Built fire trails out in Idaho, all over the road. These fires they had today, we had trails cut through there with our dozers and everything.
Yeah.
We were all over the country.
Yeah, building the national parks, building dams, building roads.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, and planting trees like crazy across the Midwest
to
stop the Dust Bowl.
Kansas.
Yeah.
When the wind blew through there in that dust storm, we were out there. All the camps around there pulled in and planted thousands of trees.
Yeah, which is what put an end to the Dust Bowl.
That put an end to it. Well, now they crook the rows instead of going straight across the field. They wave them back and forth so they break up the velocity of the wind.
Right. And it worked. Harold, thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing your experience and wisdom with all of us. I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Good talking with you. We'll be right back. It is 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. No, I'm not trying to scare anybody about cell phones. I was just curious, you know, if anybody's had a similar experience to mine. Like I said, I think it might just be heat from the battery. I don't know. I really don't know. Chris in Seattle. Listening on KKZN. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Tom, hey, Chris from Everett. I just wanted to comment real quick on John Podesta, real quick about the Jonestown comment. There's actually a little-known story that got out on HuffPost saying that Mr. Podesta supports full UFO disclosure. I don't know if you heard that. He's a real big supporter of
good on him for that, and good on him for calling out the Republican Party as a Jim Jones cult, because they are killing their own cult members by denying them health care, by denying them food stamps, by denying them unemployment benefits. People are going to die as a result of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I had a quick comment. I was actually flying a couple months ago from Denver to Seattle, and I was at a good 30,000 feet, and I switched on my my portable radio, which I'm sure you know you're not allowed to do, but I thought, you know, am I going to pick up any signals? And I was amazed. I was a good probably 400 or 500 miles out of Denver, and I was picking up the blowtorch KOA, I mean, crystal clear, up until probably Boise, the Oregon border.
Yeah, but that's receiving a radio station. That's to be expected, because you're up in the air, and in fact, that doesn't surprise me at all. But being able to communicate with a cell phone tower requires the tower to hear the signal that your phone is transmitting. And I don't think that listening to a radio is a whole different thing than talking on a phone.
I see. I wasn't quite sure if you could like replicate that technology somehow but I guess
I mean your pilots are talking on normal radio waves all the time. I mean they don't have, you know, towers up in the air. It's towers off the ground. That makes perfect sense that you could do it with a radio, but the question is the cell phone. Chris, thanks a lot for the call. Steven in Arroyo Seco, New Mexico. Am I saying that right, Steven?
Yeah. Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great. What's up?
such a pleasure to talk to you. I'm a constant companion. Two documentaries about cell phone radiation. One is Full Signal.
Uh-huh.
The other, Resonance, Beings of Frequency. I gave my cell phone up about 10 years ago when I started to develop a very tender place on the side of my head that was swollen slightly and occasionally painful.
Huh.
When I gave up the cell phone, it went away.
Yeah.
And there seems to be some scientific evidence that the microwave radiation coming off of cell phone towers interferes with the pineal glands manufacturing of melatonin, which reduces the amount of melatonin in our bodies and thus our body's ability to get rid of free radicals and disease. And
yeah, melatonin is a super, super, super potent antioxidant, and it regulates our circadian rhythms. But
exactly.
you just said the cell phone towers. Now, the towers are a whole different thing than the cell phone itself. The towers are producing very, very high levels of radiation, although they sit on top of a lot of buildings where somebody living on the top floor of that building is just bathed in that stuff all time, all day long.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's
They're everywhere. 5 million of them, I think, across the planet right now. Yeah. We're kind of experimenting with microwaving ourselves. Plus, the resonance created by all of this could be interfering with bird migration, the disappearance of bees.
Yeah, I've seen the bee thing.
There's a lot of information out there that is being squashed by the cell phone companies.
Yeah.
It's a billion-dollar industry.
It is. But whether they're squashing information or whether there's just bad science, I honestly don't know. Stephen, thank you for the call. Bob in Marcells, Illinois. Hey, Bob.
And squashing of information and bad science definitely go together, Tom.
Uh-huh.
But in any event, I called on the cell phone radiation, and basically the phone in the plane and the 5 mile distances. If you think about that, I've communicated 4 and 5 miles to a tower on the ground because I live in the boonies.
Right.
Now, if you're doing,
but you weren't traveling 500 miles an hour.
No, but I've done it traveling 60 miles an hour when I should have had the phone in my pocket. But in any event, I'm on the ground, Tom, and it's not line of sight. It's line of sight parallel to the ground.
Now,
when you're up in an airplane, you can do amazing things with the lousy quarter or half watt out of a cell phone.
Yeah, well, you could, but, you know, first law of antennas is at least high frequency antennas. When you get above, when you get into your VHF and above, 100 megahertz and above, or arguably 50 megahertz and above, is that you want to concentrate. You want to basically have what are called polarized antennas. You want to concentrate your signal. Why blow a signal into the sky when there's nobody in the sky listening to it? Low frequency, you do that because you can bounce off the ionosphere. But when you get into the high frequencies, they'll penetrate the ionosphere. So your cell towers are sending horizontal, signals horizontally, and they're constant, putting on, just like with FM radio. The FM tower, the FM antennas radiate the energy out horizontally to, because FM is almost line of sight. Whereas AM radio is below, that's low frequency stuff. It can actually bounce off the ionosphere, and that's why you can hear long distance at night when the ionosphere is active.
When I take my cell phone and set it down, and the inertia indicator in the phone switches it from one screen orientation to the next.
Right.
I still get reception. The orientation of the signal makes a big difference. In fact, that's why we have satellite TV. You have, on every frequency, you have normally got at least two signals, and it's controlled by the orientation. You have a horizontal frequency on one channel off a dish network satellite, and you have a vertical one, and they manage to double the bandwidth by using that.
By polarizing the signals.
Yeah. Now, what you were saying about the ability of the plane company, of the airlines, to put some sort of repeater on, like the one you had from AT&T,
right.
That makes perfect sense because they've already got, I believe, through the satellites that are geosynchronous, the high one.
Right, they're already doing this with Wi-Fi. That's how they do Wi-Fi, is they put a Wi-Fi repeater in the plane. I think if they can figure out a way to make a buck off it, they will do it. And then you're probably going to have some flights or some airlines that are like silent. Like on Amtrak, they got one car where you can't use your cell phone. It's the silent car. It's going to be interesting to watch how it plays out. Bob, thanks for the call. Thanks for listening to WCBT. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. Solar World has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartmann.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartmann.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. Well, down in Florida, the state government, Rick Scott, has allowed a Festivus pole to be, displayed on state property, along with a creche, along with a Birth of Jesus display, a nativity scene. And there are a few other obligatory, I don't mean obligatory, but, you know, okay, let's have the major religions, you know, okay, there's a Star of David or whatever there is there. I frankly don't have the whole list, but then the Satanists came along and said, hey, you know, we want to have our symbol there, the upside down star, the five-pointed star. When it's right side up, the top points straight up like the head. It's like Leonardo da Vinci's, you know, human, you know, it's the five-pointed star like you see on our flag. Where the head is at the top, and then the two side arms are the arms sticking out, and the two bottom points are the legs. And it's like man, right, or human. Whereas you flip that upside down, then the two points at the top are the horns of the goat, and the two stars points sticking out to the side are the big ears of the goat, and the one sticking down at the bottom is the chinny chin chin, and that's the Satanist symbol. And so the Satanists are like, you know, we'd like our symbology there. And the state's saying no. Dr. Michael Brown is with us. He's the founder and president of the Fire School, F-I-R-E, School of Ministry in Concord, North Carolina. He's the host of the Line of Fire radio show. His website, askdrbrown.org, doctor as in DR, askdrbrown.org is the website. Dr. Michael Brown, welcome to the program.
Hit me through with you, Tom. Thanks so much.
Thanks for joining us. So do you think the Satanists should be allowed to put their upside-down star on the state property?
No, I don't. Look, I am sensitive to the argument of religious liberty, and that means religious liberty for all. I'm sensitive to that, but there's also an aspect of history. There's also an aspect of heritage. There's also an aspect of, look, what if some group worships aliens, you know, the Raelians or something, and they want to
right.
explain. You know,
well, actually, the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster got their wish, and they have, they call themselves Pastafarians, and they believe that, you know, the creator is this massive spaghetti with two giant meatballs that kind of look like eyes.
Right.
They have their symbol there, and that was accepted by the state. So, you know, that's pretty close to aliens.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty close and equally ridiculous. The fact is, I think that's wrong as well, that the whole purpose of religious liberty is not to say that everybody who has any belief can display it publicly and everyone has to accept it. There is a certain heritage we have. No, we were never a, quote, Christian nation, but we do have certain Judeo-Christian roots. We do have certain things that we honor historically. But it is a major Muslim holiday. They want an opportunity to present. That's one thing. I still think there has to be a distinction made, especially when this is a sacred time to many Jews with Hanukkah and Christians with Christmas.
Well, Hanukkah's over now, you know, this year.
Hanukkah's over, but I'm just saying generic.
I get what you're saying. Isn't, though, this a very, very strong argument for the separation of church and state to say, you know, there shouldn't be any religious symbology here? This is state property, the business of the state is to take care of the roads and make sure that the sewers work and you know, keep airplanes from running into each other and run the army. The business of the state is not to promote, endorse, or, you know, be a place on which the logo of any religion, whether it's Christianity or Satan worshiping, is put.
it's a fair argument to raise. I recognize, of course, the constitutional conflicts, we're not from religion, freedom of religion.
Right.
The flip side, though, could be argued, which is, okay, doesn't the government also represent the people? And these national holidays, there's no national Satan holiday. December 25th, no one's going to...
Well, there is. It's Halloween.
...be working.
Halloween is your national Satan holiday, although it's not a... I don't know. Is Halloween a federal holiday?
No,
I don't think it is.
No,
but everybody celebrates it, right?
Right, but that's fine. It's fine to do it. I mean, whatever. Of course, it doesn't even go back to being a satanic holiday in its origins. But the fact is, there is something different about Christmas that's recognized. There is something different about certain other days of the year. I think the government should recognize that and say, hey, this is a public place. We are not a godless nation. We are just a nation that does not put forth one religion on everybody. So to me, it's absurd. And I do understand your logic. I don't think it's...
Well, let's, you know, if we take that to the next logical step, and because people, if you look around the world, what you find is Aboriginal and Indigenous people who've never heard of Christianity, and certainly you can find the evidence of this from thousands of years ago in these Stonehenge-like settings all around the world, literally all around the world you find them, have celebrated the winter solstice in various ways, typically, particularly in the northern and extreme southern climates, where you know the days were starting to get really noticeably short and things weren't growing anymore. You know, like in I used to live in Germany, and in Germany the tradition was that the pre-Christian tradition was that the high priest of the local pagan group would find the biggest tree on the top of the closest mountain, and on the shortest day of the year, which is typically around December 23rd, 24th. Would light that tree on fire, would just flame that sucker up and in order to reignite the sun. And then the next day, the days would be a little longer, and over the next few weeks, the days would get longer and longer and longer, and all the people would say, he did it again, and he gets to be the priest for another year. And so, I mean, there's a long tradition of celebrating the winter solstice, and there are Christian scholars who argue that Jesus was actually born in March, but, you know, that date got moved back to so that the Roman pagans and the Roman Christians, as Rome became, you know, as the Roman Empire morphed into the Catholic Church, the Roman Empire, that they could have that, they could still have their winter solstice celebration. Why don't we just start calling it a winter solstice celebration? And that way you could call it Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, Christmas, whatever you want. And but solstice is not viewed as a religious event at all. It's an astronomical event.
Yeah, it simply comes to the majority heritage of Americans. Still, as secular as we can be in many ways, about 75% of Americans identify as Christians.
Okay, so you think we should still have a federal holiday that we call Christmas as opposed to winter solstice?
Certainly.
Okay, yeah, a quick question about all this.
Part of our national heritage.
Yeah, okay, here's another question. The upside down star is the universally accepted, you know, symbol of Satan worshipers. In 2000, when the Republicans flipped the star upside down on their logo, the official logo of the GOP now no longer has the five-pointed star with the star right side up like it is on our flag. They flipped it upside down into the Satan worshipping star. Should we be concerned about the GOP, the Republican Party's logo, being a Satan worshipping logo?
I have to have a ready answer, Tom, for questions asked, but I don't have the slightest. I've paid zero attention to that.
Yeah, go to GOP.org. You can see it. You know, Republicans.
I will examine it carefully and maybe write a whole book about it. But seriously, I haven't.
This is a dead serious question. I have been trying to find a Republican. I've asked hundreds of them over the last 8 years. Why did you guys flip the stars upside down, turn them into either the satanic stars or, you know, the upside down flag is an international distress signal. So it's either distress or Satan, one or the other. Why did you do this?
Hey, look.
And I've not been able to get an answer.
Well, unfortunately, I can't help you with that. If I prepared for it, I would have dug something up. But the fact is, you know, there are things about Procter & Gamble. They have satanic symbol. I'm not one of these.
But they have right side up stars. There's 13 of them, but they're up right side up.
Right. The bottom line for me, though, is that there is a place to recognize national heritage. There is a place to recognize this is a sacred day for Christians around the world. It's been celebrated for hundreds of years.
So in your mind, on government property, the creche is fine, the nativity scene is fine, but the Satan upside-down star is not.
Correct. And if we had a massive societal change where we became a nation of Satanists, it would change. But right now, that's not the case.
Yeah, so you're into majority rules, basically. Small d democracy.
And our heritage as well.
Yeah, okay. Dr. Michael Brown, people can read all about it over at Ask Dr. Brown, as in DR, AskDrBrown.org. Dr. Brown, thank you. And the Fire School of Ministry, the show is Line of Fire Radio Show. Thanks for being with us today.
Hey, great to be with you. Thanks a lot, Tom.
Good talking with you. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Wouldn't it be cool if in every church all across America, you know, people were raising their hand going, Minister, why do the Republicans have the Satan stars on their elephant? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And John in Madison, Illinois. Or is it Mattison? M-A-T-T-E-S-O-N. Is that how you say it, John?
Hi.
Hey, thanks for watching
Tom.
Free Speech TV. You wanted to talk about Halloween?
It's my favorite show. I love your show.
Thank you.
I kind of called to disagree with you. I don't think Halloween is satanic. I think it's actually spiritual. If you look back in history, correct?
I don't totally disagree, but it's worship. Not necessarily worshiping, but it's a holiday that the Satan worshippers will sometimes claim as theirs, and it's when the spirits of the dead come back, and you got skeletons and demons and stuff like that. And is all considered acceptable. I think if you dressed up in a Satan costume to go to a Christmas party, people would think you were really weird. But if you show up at a Halloween party in a Satan costume, that's perfectly normal.
Yeah, no, I agree. And well, I think maybe what's happened is the markets have seen it as a gift-giving holiday and decided to take it over and turn it into that.
Right.
I do agree with you that the Republicans are the goat, though. They've been a goat for 8 years, so
yeah.
Or whatever, 6 years.
I think, this happened in 2000 when George W. Bush became their nominee, and I think it was like, okay, we know that he's the devil, and we're just going to discreetly advertise it to the world and see who notices. At first I was saying that tongue-in-cheek. Increasingly, I'm starting to think maybe it's true. Look at all the people he killed.
You're right.
Look at the...
Me and my buddy knew this 10 years ago. We were like, oh, God. Now they're not even hiding it.
Yeah. Because George W. Bush metaphorically opened the gates of hell in Afghanistan and Iraq. A majority of Americans, by the way, in a recent poll from AP, say that we never should have invaded Afghanistan. Now, Obama is like, oh, Afghanistan was the good war because that's where bin Laden was. But Afghanistan offered to give him to us, and Bush said, no, I'd rather bomb you. I'm with the majority of Americans now. We never should have invaded Afghanistan. We obviously never should have invaded Iraq. We had to lie our way into that one. But this is what the Bush administration, the Bush-Cheney administration was all about. And they also flipped the stars upside down on the Republican logo. And the Republican Party still has to deal with that. And I'm still waiting for one of the major networks to ask a Republican, why on your logo? In fact, some of the networks, when they show the Republican elephant, they flip the stars right side up. And whenever I see this happen on TV where the stars are right side up on the Republican logo, I'm like, why'd you do that? That's not the Republican logo. But, it's like their art department did it. They didn't know, It's like, I'm waiting for one of the major networks to ask a Republican, why did you guys put the Satan-worshipping stars on your elephant? I haven't gotten an answer. It's just so frustrating. I can't figure it. You got any ideas, John?
I tend to believe it's intentional.
I'm sure it's intentional. I mean, obviously somebody thought the thing up. But it's like, why would they do that?
Symbol.
Yeah.
Why are we?
You put an upside down flag in your window, you can actually be arrested for, notifying the police on false pretenses for the equivalent of a prank call to 9/11 because, the upside down flag is the internationally recognized distress signal. So maybe it's that they intended to throw the country into distress. Maybe that was a warning to the rich financiers. Look out, there's going to be a crash at the end of this administration, which there was, at the end of the Bush administration. Who knows? John, thanks for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be back 20 minutes past the hour. Slightly unbalanced, Tom Hartman here with you. Today is really kind of a far-out day. I mean, cell phone radiation, upside-down stars, and the Republican logo. It's like, this is I realize I'm pushing the boundaries of credulity, I guess would be the word, but 20 minutes past the hour. Ed in Ansonia, Connecticut. Hey, Ed, do you want to get back to cell phones on planes?
Yeah, I want to say I appreciate all your shows and all your books and everything.
Thank you.
But aside from the radiation, which is bad, I don't want to be stuck in an airplane and have to listen to a lot of people talking on the phone. I don't know what how they're going to handle that. But.
Yeah, this is why I'm opposed to it. Is the aesthetics is too weak a word for it, but. But basically, in a plane, you're sitting closer to somebody on a plane than you do in any other venue other than possibly a movie theater. You're just jammed in together, you know, and for hours, and you can't get away. And I find, you know, the people who, the hyperlexics, every now and then you sit down next to somebody who's hyperlexic who just can't stop talking. And for that, I've got the noise-canceling headphones that I can plug into my iPad and just go to sleep. But, you know, somebody talking on the phone, and people tend to shout when they're on the phone, too, because the slipstream, the you know, what they hear back in their ear is not as loud as it, frankly, as I think it should be. And
right.
And it's just, it's crazy. So, yeah, I'm with you. I don't want to be stuck on a plane listening to somebody having an argument. On the other, or a discussion, or even, you know, bragging about, you know, their accomplishments at work or whatever it may be. On the other hand, if somebody wants to text or if somebody wants to do email on their phone, I have no problem with that, and phones can accommodate that with Wi-Fi technology. You don't need to turn your phone into transmit mode to do that. Is that, are you okay with that, Ed?
Yeah, I suppose
yeah.
so.
Yeah, okay. Because that's
Steve's bothering me.
Yeah, too. That's just pushing buttons. I don't have a problem with that. Okay, Ed, thanks a lot for the call. Michael in Dublin, Virginia. Hey, Michael.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine. So you really wanted to talk about the Republicans flipping the stars upside down?
Yeah, absolutely. What we got is that, you know, when you walk into the rotunda, I heard, I haven't been there, of the Capitol, whatever that place is inside the White House over there, the Capitol.
Right.
There's a up on the ceiling, there's actually George Washington in the clouds looking down as if he's at the Last Supper as a god. Now listen to this. The god Ea or Ike was known as the protector of all the people. The symbol that they had for him was a goat's head. He was the protector and share of wisdom to the people. I suggest that the Republican Party, being as wise as they are, see themselves as the protector of the people, as a God-like person. And they are putting this, that wasn't until later that the emblem of the goat was adopted from the Satanists as a symbol. But
right.
Originally, out of Babylon, it was the symbol of the God, Ea, who looked after the people.
Right.
Yes.
Actually, I mean, you can go way back. When I was in Egypt, we had an Egyptologist who took us through Luxor, Louise and I, and he could read hieroglyphics and stuff. And there was this inscription that, what was the Greek guy's name who conquered Egypt? Alexander the Great.
Ooh.
Alexander the Great had inscribed into, you know, much later, a century after Luxor had been built, had inscribed into the wall an inscription that said that Alexander the Great was the reincarnation of the great god Amen, A-M-E-N, who was the original god of gods. And that's why we say Amen at the end of prayers, is like, you know, acknowledging the whole, you know, the great god of gods. That one left me scratching my head, and I've seen that, and I've seen it refuted, and you know whatnot. But you know, if you talk to Satan worshippers, they will tell you that Lucifer in the Bible was one of the angels, and that he fell from grace, but he's still one of the angels. He's the bearer of light. It's a Lucifer. Luciferine is the, you know, it's a there's a way to characterize him as a good guy rather than a bad guy. I'm not into that kind of stuff, but it's just, you know.
Right. Tom?
Yeah.
Tom, Lucifer is the Latin word for the morning star.
That's right.
Yes, so that has nothing to do with evil. That's just a Latin word. But so what we're looking at is these people, these Republicans, know something, and they're letting the people know something that we don't need to know that they think.
Yeah.
Look,
well, there's something behind flipping the stars upside down on the Republican logo. There's something behind it. And whether it's like some deep metaphysical you know, Masonic or whatever thing, you know, like the founders, you know, had all these, I mean, look at the back of a dollar bill, right? Or yeah. whether it was just like some dumb graphic arts guy thought, why don't we differentiate ourselves from the Democrats? We'll flip the stars upside down without realizing.
I'm sure they went to an advertising agency and locate the advertising agency that works for the Republican Party, and we may be able to find out exactly the reason for it.
Well, I have asked, you know, guys who are like senior Republicans, and they've gone back to the RNC and asked and gotten blank stares, you know, but I'm going to keep on asking. Michael, thanks a lot for the call. Interesting. Very interesting. Vince in Traverse City, Michigan. Hey, Vince.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Just great. We just have a minute to the break, though. You want to talk about cell phones in the air?
Okay, I'll make it quick. Yeah, in the air, NASA publishes a monthly safety newsletter for pilots, controllers, and mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, I can remember two specific stories where I got both of them were air carriers flying in the flight levels. They lost their radios, and one of them, the pilot, had a cell phone shut off in his briefcase, and he used that and used his Jepson charts to find the air traffic control.
So he was actually able to use his cell phone at altitude.
Yes.
And grab a signal.
And the other one, And the other one, the pilots did not have a cell phone, but they went in the back and got one from a passenger.
Well, that's interesting.
And we're able to work their air traffic control in.
Well, as I said, I'm just speculating based on that one experience that I had of pulling my phone out, thinking I'd turned it off, and discovering that I hadn't. And it had reached the point where it couldn't find a tower and had given up looking. And drained the battery, by the way, down to about half in the process. But that's very interesting, Vince. You're a retired air traffic controller?
That's correct.
Yeah, okay. That's another interesting piece to add to the puzzle. Fascinating. Vince, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. It is 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I'll tell you, though, even if it's technologically possible for people to talk on a plane to a cell phone, a tower on the ground, the airlines are going to try and figure out a way to control it so they can bill you for it. Good, the bad, and the very, very sequaciously ugly. Brought to you by the organic wine company, EcoWine.com. The good, Solar City. A California-based company recently announced a plan to provide free green energy for poor students in Haiti, Mali, Malawi, and Nepal. For every residential megawatt Solar City installs in 2014, it will donate a full solar power system to a school that doesn't have electricity. Solar City believes that it will install between 475 and 525 residential megawatts next year. So that means they could set up over 500 schools in some of the world's poorest countries with access now to totally renewable energy. It's too bad Republicans in Congress make it almost impossible for the government to do what Solar City is doing. But in the meantime, Solar City should be commended for its part in working towards a renewable future. The bad, Phil Perry. According to a new report in Politico magazine, Perry, a hotshot D.C. lawyer who is the husband of Liz Cheney, is registered to vote in both Wyoming and Virginia, despite signing a document in Wyoming certifying that he was only registered in that state. Although Perry has said he will take his name off Virginia's voter rolls, the report is sure to cause trouble for his wife, who is running for Senate in Wyoming against incumbent Senator Mike Enzi. But while that's nice, the real story here is that Republicans finally have proof that voter fraud is real. And the guilty person is one of their own, a fellow Republican. They'll savor this one for a while. And the very, very ugly, Brian Fisher. Phil Robertson, the star of A&E's new hit reality show Duck Dynasty, was suspended today in the wake of homophobic comments he made in an interview with GQ. Robertson told reporter Drew Magary that he thought homosexual sex was unnatural and not logical. While Robertson has been rightly criticized for his comments, not everyone thinks he's such a bad guy. Brian Fisher of the American Family Association let everyone on Twitter know how he feels about Robertson. He said, Phil Robertson is a new American hero. He said exactly what the great majority of Americans believe. Whether or not a majority of Americans actually do agree with Robertson is beside the point. What he said was ignorant. The fact that anyone who could find homophobia worthy of hero worship is just very, very ugly. Let me add to that, by the way. Ted Cruz just came out and said that he thinks that Phil Robertson is, you know, a good guy. He's the new American hero. It's like this is the point that I was making a couple of days ago, and I said when the right does their talking points, they do them based on culture, on beliefs. When the left does talking points, they do them on policy, on, you know, what's best or worse, what's going to work, what's, you know, and as opposed to on culture. And culture is really potent stuff, which is why the right has so much potency in this country. And I think, frankly, that the left could learn some lessons from that. But anyhow, New Mexico, by the way, just okayed the Supreme Court. Said gay marriage is legal in this state, according to the Constitution of the state. So New Mexico has now become the latest state to have gay marriage. Meanwhile, Barack Obama has commuted the sentence of 8 people who were convicted of selling crack cocaine. This is, I think, a statement by the Obama, arguably, but I think it's a fair assessment. This is a statement by the Obama administration that enough with the war, you know, Nixon's war on drugs already. This is crazy stuff. Meanwhile, Vladimir Putin has pardoned, well, actually, the Duma, the Russian parliament, in a unanimous vote, pardoned the two Pussy Riot members and the, I think it's 30, Greenpeace protesters, among others. And it looks like the billionaire who was politically opposing Putin about 10 years ago, who's been put in prison, has also been pardoned. So pardons on both sides of the Atlantic. That's interesting. The United Methodist Church, this is the church that I was raised in, has officially defrocked a pastor for officiating at the wedding of his own son who is gay. That, I think, is really wrong. The NRA has raised $256 million this year. This is the best year ever. Right? The more people who die, the more money the NRA can raise. And Brian Boitano has announced that he is gay. He's the part of the delegation that's going to the Russian Olympics. So President Obama is not going, and the vice president is not going. Neither of the first ladies are going. But the delegation that's going looks to be an all-gay or mostly gay delegation. It's going to be headed up by Janet Napolitano, who is not openly gay, but there's been a lot of speculation about over the years. But she's going along with a bunch of openly gay athletes, which is, I think, pretty impressive. On the other hand, remember that just six years ago, when President Obama was elected, he was saying he was not in support of gay marriage. So it's like, you know, there's a certain thing about rocks and glass houses here. You know, we're getting all high and mighty about Russia having laws against homosexuality when we actually arguably still have on the books laws against homosexuality at the federal level and in a lot of the states. And just 2 years ago, our president was saying he was not in favor of gay marriage. You know, give people a little time, would you? I realize that's probably not a politics statement, but I think that what we're going to see is countries all over the world, it's going to take them a little while to catch up with us. Not just Russia. I mean, you know, the real problem is places like Uganda, where you've got, you know, the Jim DeMint organization, you know, the family here, these right-wing Republican senators who all live together in the same house, you know, funding guys to go over saying kill gay people in Uganda. Those are, that, you know, serious, serious horror stories. So Russia may be a decade or two or more behind the United States in terms of enlightenment around gay issues. But I believe that they are, I think the entire world is moving in the right direction on this. And I think that the president's doing the right thing. I think that we're not going to engage you. Jimmy Carter refused to send a delegation to the Soviet Olympics back in his day. You know, that was a whole different thing. Russia's not the Soviet Union. So we'll see. We'll see how this all plays out. The Senate has finally passed that budget deal, by the way. that they allowed the vote on. And there's a few other things. Max Baucus is going off to China, whatnot. So pretty good list over at the Daily Beast, actually, dailybeast.com. I was just basically sharing the headlines with you. Sky in Oroville, Washington. You don't think that Halloween is a Satanist holiday? I wasn't asserting that it was. I was asserting that the Satanists have claimed it is theirs. There's a subtle distinction there, Sky.
Okay, well, I must have misunderstood you, but I'm a big fan of yours, and I read some of your books. But to me, for my teachings of Halloween, our holidays kind of go in a cycle. They're in a circle. There's the starts off at about Christmas time with the birth of our God, and throughout the year he gets older and older. And then on Halloween, it's we call it Samhain, but it's the end of it's Halloween. It is the symbolic death of his symbolic death.
Right.
It's time for us to mourn. We're bringing in our cross. We're, you know, this is the traditional way of
well, the big three holidays, you know, the fall holiday, Halloween, and arguably Thanksgiving, are harvest holidays, and then they have to do with the autumn equinox. The spring, big spring holiday, you know, Easter has to do with the spring equinox or whatever it's called, and then
right.
the winter solstice is Christmas.
Right, spring is the return of the birth, the renewal.
Right, but there's not a summer solstice holiday that's a big deal in popular culture.
Not in our world, you know,
right.
Not in the mainstream world, but. What happened was, is in, especially in the Celtic traditions, and though this is where Halloween really comes from, and not saying that there's other places that didn't have their own holidays. Mexico has like the Day of the Dead, but the Celtic tradition, which I'm very big into, it was when their God passed away. It was they were bringing in their crops.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then they get the Catholic religion that's coming in and saying this is the one true way. So of course they cast in the light of. Oh, this is a Satan holiday. This is the devil. And so when I hear someone say, oh, well, the Satanists have Halloween. Well, no, they don't have Halloween. They may have given it to them, but it's not their holiday.
Right. But my point earlier that if you show up at a Christmas party dressed as Satan, you're going to be the odd man out. If you show up at a Halloween party dressed as Satan, nobody's going to give it a second thought.
And that's kind of where we find the irony that you know, they say we're Satanists or that we believe in Satan because we don't even believe in a devil. We do have a horned god, which was the
who is not a bad guy.
No, he wasn't a bad guy.
Right.
And he became the Christian Satan.
Well, maybe the Republicans aren't Satanists. Maybe they're just pagans.
Oh, please don't blunt them up with me.
I'm sorry to do that to you, Scott.
Anyway, I just wanted to my little blip here of we're not Satanists, and Halloween is not a satanic holiday.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I'll give you that. And as I said, I was making that distinction, but it was a subtle one, and people listening very often miss the subtle point. Sky, thank you. So now it's explicit. Sky, thanks a lot for the call and the clarification. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour here on the Tom Harbin Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And Florida has said Festivus, you know, beer cans, that's fine, but you know, upside down star? No, you can't have that. Put that on the elephant. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. And Gregory in Cuesta, New Mexico. Hey, Gregory, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am fine. Thank you very much. I hope you are well.
I'm doing good. It's cold up here, skiing.
Oh, you're in the mountains?
Yeah, we're up in Taos at the Taos Ski Valley.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you ski, but it's really neat.
I've never learned how to ski. I've done cross country, but I've never done downhill in my whole life. It sounds like something I would love to do, but I just never got around to it. I grew up in Michigan. It's kind of flat. So.
Right. Well, cross country, as long as you try to keep your heart strong.
Yeah. Yeah. Cross country, you get out of breath pretty fast. We did a lot of that in Vermont, or in New Hampshire, rather. Back in the 70s.
It's kind of like running.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you wanted to talk about Celtic heritage and Catholics?
Well, yeah. What, you know, from my heritage being Scottish and Irish, mm-hmm. when we looked back on our all of, like you've been talking about, you know, Christmas and Easter, we looked up all of these holidays and noticed that the Catholics brought these holidays into their
conquered lands
service. Yeah. So we would, so we would go and have their services feeling like they were still partly our holidays.
Because the Celts, the pre-Christian Celts, had holidays that were simultaneous with the autumn equinox, the winter solstice, and the spring equinox.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, and a lot of the those are our holidays, Easter and Christmas, and
right.
I kind of would like to go back to the Celt days. Oh, and on the social issues, I wish we really would go more back to social. A lot of us need some help.
Mm-hmm.
I know you showed a graph today, or it was yesterday or something, and I could not believe what percentage were nurses that we fall in. We can't invest, basically.
Yeah. I'm not sure. It must have been a different program, Gregory, or was it, our TV show?
You know what? I might have been watching Bernanke, and they threw it over there to... I watched him on Bloomberg, and they threw it over to a graph showing it was actually a really fairly decent graph, and it showed who was investing, et cetera, and was able to. But I'm sure back in the Celtic days, they were social.
Well, yeah, you look at Aboriginal indigenous societies, they typically have ways of recalibrating wealth. For example, in the Bible, the old Jewish tradition was every 49 years, everybody threw everything they owned into the pot, and or every 50th year, 7 times 7, and then the year following. They called it a jubilee, and all wealth was equalized and completely redistributed, and everybody started out all over again at the same spot. And that's pretty cool. I think it's time for one of those things. Gregory, thank you for the call. We'll be back. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour, and we will get back to your calls in just a little bit. But first, Bob Nay with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. You can give a gift of a goat to a returning slave in South Sudan, which is in crisis right now, by the way, South Sudan. Bob Nay, welcome back to the program, Congressman.
Thank you. How are you?
I am well, and I should add, the author of Sideswiped. If you want to know what's going on in Washington, D.C., read this book. Hey, Bob. So what's going on in the world today?
Well, there's a lot. Cornucopia, Tom, of information. The Senate has passed the budget deal, and, of course, some of the people reading that think the numbers are there. There's some guidelines. It just averts basically a shutdown. And, of course, they've got to fill in the pieces now, the Appropriations Committee. There's speculation on the Hill right now, Tom, that, this strengthens the hand of Speaker Boehner. He'll be able to do something now, and the fight's really with the debt ceiling. The Republicans are having a retreat in January. I predict to you they can holler, they can scream. This doesn't give them leverage with the debt ceiling. The president will not budge on that debt ceiling, and they cannot afford a shutdown through the debt ceiling process. So,
well, and if they did it with the debt ceiling, that wouldn't just be a shutdown. That would be a default as well, which would be a disaster for the planet.
Yeah, it would just absolutely make the system go haywire and would, by all rights, shut down our economic abilities.
Yeah, this is like those guys down in Mexico who robbed that truck and inside was the nuclear material from a hospital or something, and five of these guys show up at dying of radiation sickness because they stole this stuff and they thought, oh, this must be really important, and it turned out it was like pure cesium or radium or something, and I mean, that's what they're playing with. They're playing with high-level radiation when they're talking about the debt ceiling.
Sure, and I don't think it's where Speaker Boehner just grew a backbone to tell the House what they're going to do. I think Paul Ryan, who ran for vice president with Mitt Romney, stepped in and saved the Republican Party from itself.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to be running for president again. My read of this is that he's going to be running for Speaker of the House, and he wants to be in Congress or maybe the Senate one day, but over the short term, Speaker of the House, and he wants to have power in the House of Representatives.
That's what I think, and he's lined himself up for it. The second thing is that the panel has spoken to limit some of the NSA spying, and I think there's some, it's viewed as some pretty sound recommendations coming out of there that they just shouldn't be allowed to mine everything. The president's got problems with some of the points, but I think the Congress and the president will latch onto this as a sort of a way out to bring some type of rational reasoning, I would assume.
I liked the idea of the new NSA director being a civilian who is, you know, answerable to Congress, basically, you know, that has to be vetted by the Senate. The founders were all about that. That's why the commander in chief of the military is a civilian, the president of the United States, rather than, you know, an army guy. I mean, they just didn't trust the military.
Right. And the president doesn't like the tinkering with the cyber chief, et cetera, you know, which was, I think, created under Bush at one point in time. But
right. But
they might come to terms with that because I think it's a healthy recommendation. A lot of them actually are that are out there. There's the Egypt and Iran are in the news in the sense that the Senate is really pushing, and this I kind of found this really humorous, Senator Menendez and Mark Kirk, that's a combination from heaven, and those two have sat down and said, well, you know, we really need to give the White House a tough bargaining position. So they're doing, protest some additional sanctions, maybe protesting the Baha'i faith and how they're treated in Iran. But what's interesting is the White House doesn't want that additional power. The White House wants this to sit a bit, rightfully so, but the Senate's pushing. So I think we're going to see the White House play some hardball with the Senate.
That's good because the neocons could screw this thing up really badly. It looks to me like Iran is getting ready to rejoin the nations of the world.
I mean, President Obama has, and I predict this, will go down in an international legacy if he can accomplish this, and he's almost there, as doing one of the most major foreign policy coups in the last 30 years to do something actually about the nuclear situation in Iran and also bring Iran back into the fold of the world. So it's a major initiative, and the Congress really needs to, you know, not be doing what it's doing, but, you know, it's out there, you know, beating the drum. And on Egypt, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee voted 16-1, Rand Paul was the no, to give President Obama flexibility to continue aid to Egypt, give him a little bit of a wiggle room, which is probably a good thing, too.
Yeah, I agree.
Yes, and then the India diplomatic row, that's the one other thing. The federal prosecutor had her arrested. She didn't pay her maid the $9 an hour, but $3 an hour. India is now saying, you know what? You've underpaid the Indians working for you. Maybe we ought to make a few arrests. So,
oh, really?
Secretary of State, yes, because, I just got back from India 24 hours ago, as you know, and India has uncovered that the Americans are paying Indian workers at the American embassy the lowest rate possible, not comparable to Americans at all.
Very interesting. Are we doing it outside of or within Indian law?
Well, within Indian law, we're fine.
Yeah.
But they're paying a rate.
Because that's the argument here is that this maid was being paid outside of American law. Although, isn't there an exemption in the minimum wage laws for maids?
Well, I think there is. She was paying her $3 an hour under a contract. She lied, and the whole point of this is let's, you know, reverse this. If an American didn't follow Indian minimum wage law, he was a diplomat. He walks outside the embassy. He's arrested and strip searched in India. We would be
going nuts.
Every point of communication. The prosecutor should have followed what you follow in diplomacy, put the protest into the embassy, forced them to do something about her, you know.
Right.
And they strip searched her and charged her with a felony, and it's just...
Whoa, that's a mistake.
Secretary of State Kerry has communicated directly with India, and I wouldn't call it a weak apology. He's trying to follow protocol.
Was this a local police prosecutor thing that just didn't understand international diplomacy, or was the State Department in on this? I'm just learning about this myself.
Well, no, the State Department is They're apologizing. They're saying they're sorry for how she was treated. They have publicly said that.
So this was a woman who was a diplomat with the country of India here in the United States who had a maid that she had brought with her, and she is underpaying her by our standards.
Yes, and then New York prosecutor went after her and didn't follow the protocol.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm going to have to read up on that. Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. You can read about it over there. And goats for the old goat.com. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. Be sure to check out Bob's book, Sideswiped. We'll be back with Ona Porter. Let's talk about ending poverty in the United States. Not just mitigating it, but ending it.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It has been a lot of years since we've had a conversation in the United States about ending poverty as opposed to simply helping out poor people. And, there are some great organizations out there that are actually engaging in that conversation. How do we actually end poverty? Ona Porter is with us. She's the president and CEO of Prosperity Works. ProsperityWorks.net is the website. Ona, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Glad to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Tell us about Prosperity Works and what you're doing there in New Mexico.
Well, Tom, we have a vision, really, that every New Mexican may have the opportunity and the knowledge and relationships that they need to achieve economic security and prosperity. And we have designed a whole host of products and services to support that vision. And they all really are around building assets, personal assets, social assets, and financial assets, we believe are the three-legged stool of controlling your life. And we also believe that assets are critical to your future, that income is good, and if we have enough of it, that's even better. But income gets you by. It's assets that get you ahead. So our focus in the opportunity ladder is on building assets.
So what's a social asset?
Well, there are many social assets. One of those is certainly who you know. And, you know, we talk about ghettos, but we think of those as physical places. In fact, we all live in the ghetto of our own creation. And those ghettos are surrounding ourselves with people who are just like us. And so, if I have a problem with my car, my social asset is to call AAA. If a low-income person has a problem with a car, their social asset is to find a friend with a chain. And so it's who we know, it's what we know, and it's how we can maneuver in our communities to meet our basic needs and beyond those.
So how do you enhance people's social assets?
Well, you know, one of the things that we provide to people who are working on an asset development plan is a comprehensive financial capability training. And in that, we reserve 15% of the seats in the class for the community at large. And what happens in that is during those 10 weeks, we really are building what we call bridging capital. between people who would never know one another, who don't know each other's lifestyles, who don't know each other's employment or employment opportunities. And in those places, what we really find is that, that number one, for middle-income people who sit in those classes, there's never a conversation anymore in their lives about steaks and Cadillacs. They understand that low-income people are the hardest-working people that they now know. But they also understand the barriers that have been in people's lives that have kept them from, you know, achieving dreams. And so very often what happens is that those individuals who are now meeting and sharing ideas and learning in this classroom setting are really becoming advocates for one another and also friends of one another.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had people to find jobs for other people. We have had teachers go to bat when somebody was offered a job and then their credit score determined that they were not eligible for that job. And the teacher in the classroom will actually go to that employer and say, hey, this is the best bet you can get. We've also had actually individuals who have said, you know, I can help with the issues that you have in trying to build your asset. Will you allow me to do that? So that's bridging capital, and it really is breaking down barriers and opening up the world to really an understanding of people's struggles and how we get through those struggles.
That's remarkable. Now, that's social assets, so, financial assets, personal assets. Let's talk about those.
Yeah. Okay, so with personal assets, certainly a huge one of those is education. We know that people who have a high school education or less have extreme difficulty in terms of economic security. And so having access to quality education is a really important variable in terms of being able to secure a future for yourself. But in this process, one of the things also is that we are building confidence with the populations with whom we are working and agency. And agency really, from our perspective, means that people are able to understand that they have value and that they have rights and that they should be able to pursue those things with confidence. So, you know, in that, in our process, really, it's about learning and it's about stabilizing and then it's about leveraging what it is that you learn and the relationships that you have so that you can do better in your life.
We're talking with Ona Porter, President and CEO of Prosperity Works. ProsperityWorks.net is the website, doing some extraordinary work out of New Mexico. Where in New Mexico are you based?
Well, we're in Albuquerque, but we work through community-based partners. So we have partners as large as and complex as the Central New Mexico Community College. It has 6 campuses and 40,000 students, and as small as an indigenous farmers organization that has actually the largest dry land seed collection in the world.
Whoa. We have about 2 minutes left on it. Tell me about, so you talked about, we've talked about now about social capital and about personal capital or assets, financial assets. How do you, you know, this is where I opened this with, let's end poverty. That implies financial assets, right?
Right. And there are two ways that we can build financial assets. And one of those is to increase income, and the other is to decrease costs. And then also have an opportunity for some products, some financial products that allow us to save and to leverage that savings into, you know, our dreams, whether that's higher education, home ownership, starting a business, like that.
So how does what do you do there at Prosperity Works to help people do that?
So one of the products that we have available, Tom, is called an individual development account. And those are matched savings accounts. And after people complete their financial capability training, they're eligible to save. And at the same time they're saving, they're building an asset plan. And when they reach their goal, we match them 4-to-1 for the purchase of a first home, to capitalize a small business, or for higher education.
Well, now, this seems like relatively small amounts of money. Can a small amount of money have a large impact on someone's life?
Huge impact. It really is amazing. There are lots of, you know, that are individual development account savers purchase their asset usually with $5,000. If there are two members of a family saving, that would be $10,000.
So that's enough for a down payment on a house, for example.
Right, and of course, one of the things that we do with that is, in addition to that down payment, we're looking for other kinds of opportunities that might be available that they can leverage. So on average, we often have people going into their homes with about 20 to 25% equity.
Hmm. That's
so during the time that we have been doing this, which is about 5 years, and over 200 people having purchased homes, we've never had a house foreclosed upon, and we also have not had a mortgage flipped.
Remarkable. Okay. Oona Porter is her name. She's the president and CEO of Prosperity Works. You can read all about it over at prosperityworks.net. Thanks for being with us today.
You bet. Thank you, Tom.
Great talking with you. Be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is something that needs to be replicated all across the country. Prosperityworks.net. Welcome back. Is it Oneida, am I saying it right, in Montclair, New Jersey, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV? Oneida? Hello? You're on the air? Oneida has been on hold for 58 minutes, must be watching TV rather than listening to her phone. Sue in Vancouver, Washington, watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. Hey, Sue, you're there?
Yes.
Okay, great. So
I wanted to comment on the religious displays. You know, this time of year you see the nativity scenes on public property.
Mm-hmm.
And I always carry around an old Molly Ivins article or editorial about it. And she quotes James Madison, and I think it's really one of the main reasons I carry this article around. And it says, the reason that we have separation of church and state is to keep forever from these shores the ceaseless strife that has soaked the soil of Europe with blood for centuries.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That is. Go ahead.
Well, that's kind of the key. You know, my mother was an atheist and I'm not, but her religion didn't matter. And like Molly Ivins jokes in this article about maybe if we throw in Santa Claus and some Kwanzaa and a menorah in the nativity scene, it might please everybody. But the point is, we just need to not mix up our public.
Yeah. Now, for the people who might have just tuned in, what Sue is talking about is in the previous hour or maybe 2 hours ago. No, it was last hour. Dr. Michael Brown came on, and he's a pastor and got a radio show, Christian radio show. And down in Florida, they put up on state property a Christian nativity scene, and then the Festivus people came along and said, we want our pole of beer cans, and they said, okay, that's fine. And then the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster came along and said, we want to put up a Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster. They said, okay, that's fine. And then the Satanists came along and said, we want to put a pentagram, a five-pointed star, upside-down star there. And the state said, no, that's grossly offensive. We can't do that. And so the Satanists are kind of the odd man out. They're feeling badly about this. Now, of course, this is the logo for the Republican Party, the upside-down star, but it's also the logo for the Satan worshipers. And that's what you're commenting on. And I find it interesting that, you know, when you read the correspondence between James Madison and Thomas Jefferson, it's fascinating about the separation of church and state. Read their correspondence before the Constitutional Convention of 1787. And Jefferson was worried that priests might end up running government. He didn't want priests to be able to run for public office. Madison was concerned that if the government got involved with religion, particularly funding religion, which is why that was his first veto as president, was funding the government giving money to a church to care for the poor, that it would corrupt religion. So Madison was a good Christian, and he was worried about Christianity being corrupted. Jefferson was a deist. He was not a Christian, and he was worried about the Christians taking over the country. And it seems to me like right now we have the worst of both worlds, with, you know, billions of dollars being given to the churches by the government, corrupting the churches, and then, you know, you've got the churches then trying to take government space, public space. So anyhow, Sue, thank you for sharing that James Madison quote with us. It's brilliant. Thank you so much. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. We'll be right back. Okay, we've covered a lot of territory here in the program so far. My wondering why it is that the spot on my stomach, which is next to where my cell phone sits when I'm going in and out of the subway, talking on the earbuds to Louise, and the cell phone has to work super hard to get a signal, and then it loses the signal, and I actually have what feels like a little burn on my skin. And is that from the battery being hot or from the microwave radiation? And is that, you know, now I'm just putting the phone into airplane mode, which leads us to airplanes on cell phones on airplanes. Do you want to be sitting next to somebody who's talking on a cell phone on a plane? I frankly don't. I think the airplanes are kind of a unique space in that we get jammed in. They're like cattle cars. And we tolerate it because you can travel, you know, 500 miles an hour, and there's no other way to go that fast, you know, some long distance. But having the person next to you, you know, having an argument on the cell phone, or even I love you so much, honey, you know, a love affair on the side, or just talking business, whatever it is. I mean, who wants that? Apparently, though, some of the airlines have figured out a way, and I think that they're doing it with these micro cell towers that you can get. AT&T sells one if you live in a bad coverage area, where you can put up your own tower, plug an internet connection into it, and it allows you to talk on the telephone. The cell phone talks to the tower at cell phone frequencies, but then the tower carries your conversation to AT&T over the internet. And I'm guessing that some of the airlines are thinking, you know, we can put these towers on the planes and we can force people to sign into them and charge them $5 or $10 for the privilege of being on the phone in the plane, because they're doing this with Wi-Fi right now, too. Hotels are doing it with Wi-Fi. So, you know, it's all about, you know, how do we get an extra buck? How do we make some extra money? So your thoughts on whether you want to be sitting next to somebody with a cell phone, is it even technologically possible? And somebody raised the issue of the 9/11 cell phone calls. I don't think those planes were at altitude. I made the point that, it's been 2 or 3 years now, but a couple of years ago, I'm pretty fastidious about it and have been ever since because it drained my battery. But I had my cell phone in my sports coat on the plane. The plane took off. I thought the phone was turned off. We get up to altitude and, you know, you can get up, move around, whatever. You can get your computers out. I pull out my cell phone and it is still turned on. I mean, you know, not in airplane mode, but it has given up on trying to find a tower. Yeah, and I think it's because we were high enough up and we're traveling 500 miles an hour. Even if it could have grabbed a tower, I don't think it could communicate. I don't think the towers can hand off fast enough to hand you off from tower to tower. You can do it when you're traveling 60 miles an hour on the ground, but 550 miles an hour over the ground at an altitude of several miles, I just don't think it's technologically possible. Plus, you'd have cell phones blowing out. I mean, they have to blow out a fairly high amount of radiation, particularly given that you're in a metal tube. You've got a Faraday cage, basically, you know, in an airplane. A Faraday cage, Mr. Faraday, back the guy who, I don't know, did he invent the capacitor or just, but anyhow, something to do with the capacitor. But you know, this was late 19th century, as I recall, discovered that if you put a wire cage that was grounded, and it could have giant holes in it. I mean, you know, it's like chicken wire, right? But a cage that was grounded, that radio waves wouldn't pass through it of various frequencies. And and this led to the discovery of wavelengths and all kinds of interesting things. But basically, a Faraday cage is something that blocks radio waves. And I believe, I could be wrong, but I believe that an airplane would affect it, although it's not grounded. So maybe it's not a Faraday cage. Maybe the skin of the airplane would simply pick up the radiation and re-radiate it. I don't know. That's entirely possible. Because we had a caller who is a former air traffic controller who talked about two cases where pilots were having problems. They lost their aviation radios, and they used cell phones. In one case, the pilot used his own cell phone. In another case, the pilot went and got a cell phone from somebody in the plane. But he didn't specify what altitude they were at. Because those 9/11 calls that were made using cell phones, I believe, were made at fairly low altitudes. And when a plane is at 10,000 feet, you can't fly at 500 miles an hour at 10,000 feet. You just can't do it. The planes get down to, you know, 160, 180, 200 miles an hour. And at that speed, I think that the cell phone towers can handle handing you off from tower to tower. And you're at, you know, 5 to 10,000 feet. These, you know, ultimately they were, you know, in the neighborhood of a couple, you know, 1,000 feet or so to hit the Twin Towers. That's that was the altitude. The plane in Pennsylvania, that's the wild card in this. And I don't know what altitude that plane was at, but apparently there were some people who were making cell calls. Although that was back in the days when the planes had these phones on them that the airplane company would swipe a credit card on the phone and you could have a long conversation with somebody. I've used those. And although they charge, you know, like $2 or $3 a minute, so I've only used them when I felt like it was like, but they don't even offer those anymore. But is it that the airplane companies are getting ready to get this going or not? So anyhow, a lot that we've discussed, and then Florida with the Satanists saying that you know, the Festivus cans are just fine, but Satan worshiping, no, we're not so much. We're not going to allow that. Also, this Duck Dynasty guy, Mr. Robertson, I watched a 5-minute clip of Duck Dynasty on Hulu, I think it was, but I've never seen the show on A&E. But apparently, he came out. I read the comments. He made some fairly, I mean, you could call them bigoted. I would call them more just stupid, really ignorant comments about gay sex and sexuality. And, you know, reflective of probably the generation that he's from and the culture that he's from. And A&E bounced him off the show. And so now Ted Cruz is getting in on it. And, you know, okay, here we go. The culture wars again, right? Who would really want to be fighting the culture wars?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And what I think is most interesting is that this is being framed as a First Amendment issue, but this guy's on a commercial television network. It's got nothing to do with the government. Okay, it's Thursday. This is the one day, one time, 4 or 5 minutes where Louise and Sean let me get geeky about science. So let's get geeky on global warming and evolution, from catastrophic superstorms to raging wildfires. We've all seen firsthand the devastating effects of climate change and global warming. I mean, you just look around, right? And Superstorm Sandy, mile wide tornadoes in Oklahoma. It's just, you know. But they're having more effects that are harder to see, but equally as important and startling. According to new research, a species of caterpillars having to evolve at a much faster rate thanks to climate change and the warmer weather over the past 40 years. Normally, caterpillars eat and grow in cold temperatures, but thanks to the warmer temperatures, they've had to adjust their eating schedules and their genetic makeup. We're actually watching evolution happen to be able to eat and grow in warmer temperatures. The new research shows that a specific species of caterpillar studied, the Coleus, has evolved to expand the range of its ideal feeding temperatures so that it can eat at higher temperatures. Now, at the same time that the caterpillars are doing fine, reindeer are having a real serious problem. That's because climate change and global warming are threatening their natural habitats, too. As part of a new study on the evolution of caribou, researchers at the University of Calgary pointed out that caribou need, quote, an undisturbed lichen-rich, lichen is that little kind of green moss that grows on the, you know, dead tree bark and stuff, undisturbed lichen-rich environments to survive. But as temperatures warm, these lichen-rich habitats are becoming few and far between. So the caribou are not doing well. The cases of the caterpillar and the caribou highlight the fact that some animals are able to adjust to new settings and evolve faster than others. More specifically, larger, more complex animals like caribou and us have a harder time evolving and adapting than smaller and simpler species like caterpillars. And as climate change hastens and the planet continues to warm, more and more species, including humans, are going to be forced to either evolve to live in the new environment or face the consequences. Now, it doesn't have to get to that point. There's still time to take action necessary to save our planet from the greatest threat, or at least our species, from the greatest threat that we've ever faced. But so let's protect the future of caterpillars, caribou, and humans. Okay? Sounds like a plan. Curtis in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Curtis, what's on your mind?
How are you doing today, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better. How about you?
Same here.
Okay, so what's up?
Oh, I was talking about Halloween and Christmas there. You guys were having comments on. The idea is that, you know, Santa, and Halloween has its devil.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it's a gentleman who probably wants to work 2 months out of the year. And he just dresses and he morphs from the devil on, at Halloween into Santa at Christmas and just puts a hoodie or a hat over his horns and ties his little beard, his goatee in a knot, and he's all good, right?
So you think that the Satan of Halloween is the Santa of Christmas?
Pretty much, yeah. They kind of have similar tributes to both as well.
That's an interesting theory. I find it interesting that we have a fall equinox celebration, which is basically Halloween / Thanksgiving, a harvest festival. We have harvest festivals and end of growing season festivals. And then we have a winter solstice holiday, and this is all over the Northern Hemisphere, Christmas, and that goes back to the old Stonehenge and before, you know, the shortest day of the year holidays. And then we have a spring equinox festival. It's Easter in the Christian tradition, but there's other variations in other northern religions. But there's nothing in the middle of the summer. And I think that's because in the middle of summer, everybody's busy growing stuff. And so, you know, it's like, you know, why have a party? Except that we have summer vacation, I guess. So maybe we have a secular version. I don't know. But anyhow, Curtis, thanks for the thoughts. Interesting one. Roger in Aurora, Colorado. Hey, Roger. Cell phones?
Hey, Tom, can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you just fine. Are you talking on a cell phone?
Yes, sir.
Uh-oh.
Is that not good?
I don't know. I've found that the last couple of months I've been wearing this jacket and I've been keeping a cell phone in the particular pocket of it right up against my stomach, and now I'm getting this funny little skin patch underneath where the cell phone is. And I don't know if it's heat from the battery or radiation from the cell phone or none of the above and just a coincidence. It's weird.
Well, normally when I talk on the cell phone, Tom, I keep it on a speakerphone.
Yeah, that's
a speaker option, and I keep it away from my body. I've been talking about this for a long time to people, and people act like I'm crazy. But what I wanted to mention specifically was that a couple weeks ago, I was tuning in to a Dr. Oz on the afternoon show, and there's been several incidences reported of young women who they'll put their cell phone in their bra, like teenage girls, and they develop breast cancer, and the pattern of the breast cancer and the breast tissue was the exact shape of the cell phone. And they had a surgeon on.
Now, seriously? I mean, that sounds like the Vanishing Hitchhiker stories. That sounds like a made-for-the-internet story, not a real science story.
Really? Why would you say that?
Because cancer doesn't, you know, I could see if you said you had a burn mark or you had tissue or something like that, but cancer, cancer having a particular shape, like maybe it could be in the vicinity of where the cell phone was. But
well, that's when they put the cell phone in their bra, okay?
Right.
According to the x-rays and whatever, the MRIs and whatever scans they did, it showed this is what I, you know.
Yeah.
It's neither here nor there. It could be something, maybe it's not, but.
Well, there is this explosion this increase in breast cancer. I, you know, and who knows? I didn't know that women put cell phones in their bras. although a lot of men carry them in their back pocket or their pants pockets. That raises a whole another interesting issue. Particularly the new flat phones, you know, the iPhone kind of phones. But, yeah, I guess that's enough. This is interesting stuff. I've always wondered, you know, did Teddy Kennedy use the cell phone too much? There have been some studies that suggest that cell phone use and brain cancer have a correlation, particularly a study out of Finland or Denmark. This was a while back. But see, those studies were done back 5-10 years ago when cell phones produced a lot more radiation than they do now. They've gotten much more sophisticated and the radiation levels are down. So anyhow, Roger, thanks for the call. Thanks for listening to AM 760. Vincent in Middle Village, New York. Hey, Vincent, what's up?
Hey, I listen to you. Can you hear me? I'm on a cell phone.
Yeah, you're just fine. You're irradiating your head.
No, it's on speakerphone. I'm happy to get through, and I call. I mean, I listen all the time. And I just wanted to, I was wondering, you seem to me to be the most intelligent person that I have come across. And I was wondering, a lot of people probably ask you this, but do you ever consider running for president or for the Senate? Or I know that you have Bernie Sanders on, and I know that there is a shot, hopefully, that he'll be able to run in the next presidential election, but...
Yeah.
Vincent,
thank you for the compliment. No, I here's actually why, and this, or part of why. I mean, first of all, I think most people who run for public office, seriously run for public office, people like Barack Obama who end up being president, or Bill Clinton. When Bill Clinton met JFK when he was like 12 or 13, he met JFK and shook his hand and in that moment decided I'm going to be president. And basically all the decisions he made through his teenage and years and his early 20s were things that would take him in that direction. And I never, you know, I mean, I've never done that. And so I don't have the life narrative that you need to run for political office. But more importantly, there are different types of intelligence. And Howard Gardner wrote this book called The Seven Intelligences that was a big deal. It was a New York Times bestseller back about 15, 20 years ago. And I think he was absolutely right. I met Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton and I did a fundraiser for Jim McGovern, the congressman from Washington State, who had outed Newt Gingrich for breaking federal law, outed him by playing a recording of a recorded cell phone conversation that Newt had, and Newt sued him, and McGovern needed $300,000 to pay for the legal fees, and so Bill Clinton and I did this fundraiser in Seattle for Congressman McGovern, and I was standing backstage with Bill Clinton. It was the one and only time I've ever met him, and it's just the two of us, and then, you know, his two Secret Service guys, and they're like 20 feet away, and for the 10 or 15 minutes while McGovern was on stage and we were waiting for me to go on and then introduce Bill Clinton, he just put all his energy on me. And it was like all of a sudden I was the most important person in the world. Bill Clinton has this interpersonal intelligence. He remembers people's names, which I can't do. I'm face blind. I don't recognize. So I've had my own kids. Run into my own kids walking down the street in Portland, Oregon, and not recognize them. I don't have that ability, and so I lack the type of intelligence, that interpersonal intelligence, I guess that's it, interpersonal intelligence, that I think is absolutely necessary for a politician to be successful, and that good politicians have. And also, I don't have any desire to be in elected office. I'm a pretty good author and a pretty good talk show host, and I'm doing those two things, and I'm loving it. And so I'm just going to keep doing them, and I can do them without ever having to recognize people. In fact, Vincent, thank you for the call, and thank you for the kind words. In fact, when I have guests on my TV show at night, I have a piece of paper with their name on it, and I highlight it, even when they're people who've been on over and over and over again, because I constantly have to remind myself what this person's name is. I'm so bad with names. And you can't be a politician if you're bad at it. It doesn't work.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But that doesn't mean you can't work for political change, whether it's me or you. Right? We can all support things like MoveToAmend.org and PDAmerica.org. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Robert in Spencer, Indiana, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Hey, how you doing today, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Robert.
Okay. Hey, we were talking about, you were talking about Aboriginal holidays that occur at certain times of the year.
Yeah.
And
fall, winter, and summer. Yeah. Or spring.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to make you aware of something that the Indian people of North America have been doing for centuries, and actually longer than that. They make a medicine wheel, and it's a circle, and it starts at March 21st. And then December 21st, September 21st, and June 21st. Those are the four points of the circle.
Right, the two equinoxes and the two solstices, basically.
Yes, the equinox and the solstice. But between each one of those, believe it or not, there is a holiday that lies, and it's extremely close to the ones that we celebrate. Let's see, between December 21st and March 21st, is Groundhog's Day, exactly 6 weeks.
Huh.
Okay, then from May 21st to June 20, or March 21st to June 21st, there's May 5th, Cinco de Mayo.
Right.
Okay, now this one is obscure, and it's an Indian holiday, but between June 21st and September 21st is August the 2nd, which is Sundance. This is done by all of the Lakota people.
Yeah, oh yeah, a friend of mine did
that.
Yeah,
we have one here in Bloomington too, as a matter of fact. Then September 21st, between that and December 21st, is of course October 31st.
Right, Halloween.
Which is Halloween. So there you go, and that is All Hallows Eve, and it's also the time of the ghost dance done by the Indian people.
Right. Wow.
So that's all. Would love to appreciate you hearing that, and I thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Robert. That was one of the most informative calls, information-packed calls that I've gotten in a long time. I really appreciate that. Thank you. We have the smartest viewers on Earth, I think. Alan in Jackson, Tennessee, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I wanted you to compare Chernobyl with Fukushima and tell us when all these radiation spikes are going to stop, and if they can, and meltdown.
I think that Chernobyl was in a landlocked area, and it blew radiation over a large area of land, and it blew a lot of high radiation particles. I mean, they were finding plutonium in Germany. Fukushima is right on the edge of the ocean, so we haven't had a good thorough assessment of what the seabed floor is like in the vicinity of Fukushima. And I don't think that any government wants to do it. I'm of the opinion that Fukushima is a disaster on the order of Chernobyl. The official position is that there's five levels, and it's a level four, and Fukushima is level five. So it's one level below Fukushima, and Kevin Camps has been on this program and talked about this in the past. But if that reactor 4 right now, where they're talking about taking the rods out of it, that, you know, it's the one that's listing, and it's got tons of radioactive material in up on the fifth floor in this holding pool, if they screw that up and that thing falls over, it's going to be Fukushima. It's going to be like Chernobyl. It's going to be really, really bad. So keep an eye on it. Alan, thanks for the call. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. David in Denver. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Just a couple comments regarding the cell phones.
Mm-hmm.
Firstly, in the airplane, I think the major irritation or damage from cell phone would be to your peace of mind.
Yeah, well, that was my point.
And to your seatmate yak on the phone.
Yeah, it's a quality of life issue.
Yeah, totally. And actually here in Denver on the buses, you know, the RTD we have here, mm-hmm. they have signs saying, you know, to please respect your neighbors.
Interesting.
Peace or whatever, saying, yeah, to limit your cell phones and keep them down.
Yeah, they do that on Amtrak, too.
Sure. The other thing is, when cell phones came here to Denver, at least in kind of a commercial way or, you know, widely available in the early 90s, they were the kind of you know, field phone type or the separate handset and that, and they were actually 3-watt.
Yeah, I had one of those. Yeah. You could, they were as high as 5 watts, I think, the bag phones.
Yeah, well, we had a 5 dB gain antenna on them. I don't know, mine was 3 watt, but at any rate, then when they went to the portable, the really smallish ones that you held up to your head, they went down to 6/10 of a watt.
Right, 600 milliwatts.
Right, which I think is what they are now.
No, I think now they're running around 120 to 200 in the neighborhood of 120 to 200 milliwatts, but I could be wrong. It's been some years, but I think they're down in that neighborhood. And normally they're operating, if you got 5 bars, you're operating in the 30, 40, 50 milliwatt region.
Even lower still.
Yeah.
So you can picture that, you know, even at that, you know, 0.25 watts, where, you know, something as, say, as a microwave normally runs 700 to 1100 watts.
A microwave oven,
Right, microwave oven, to be able to heat something up. And as that distance gets, you know, further and further away from the microwave, obviously, even just a few feet, it can't do any effective heating.
Right.
And I think the main concern that they're looking at with the cell phones relating to cancer development isn't so much the heating up, but is the damage to your DNA.
But how does it damage the DNA? I mean, ionizing radiation actually has the ability to bounce particles or you know, high enough energy photons that they discharge energy into an individual molecule of adenine, guanine, cytosine, thymine, you know, one of the four amino acids that make up DNA. I don't know how heat does that or how non-ionizing radiation does that. I don't believe that there's a mechanism for that.
Yeah, and you could possibly be right. I am not, you know.
Possibly he could do it. Possibly he could do it because there's this huge correlation between inflammation and cancer. But I think that probably has more to do with the chemicals associated with inflammation than the you know, literally the flame,
right.
You know, the increase in temperature.
So it's like your C-reactive protein and that?
Yeah, those kind of things, exactly.
Right, I understand.
Yeah.
Yeah, just a thought. I don't know. I personally am fairly dubious of the connection between cancer and cell phone use. It seems like as cell phones came into such widespread popularity, if there were a very direct correlation, you'd have, you know, an equally...
But there has been actually an increase in that kind of brain cancer that Ted Kennedy had. I mean, that has gone up statistically in a statistically significant way. But whether or not it's associated with cell phones is what's in dispute.
I don't know.
Yeah. Anyhow, David, thank you for the call. It's a lot of thoughtful calls today. Geralee in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Geralee, what's up?
Hi. I have a couple of things that I think are pertinent to the conversation, and you said there's no summer holiday. Well, we have the 4th of July, which was deliberately set with the Dog Star, which is precursor to the summer solstice, or just after the summer
solstice. Right, so we have a secular, so that's the summer solstice holiday is the secular holiday.
Right.
Yeah, interesting.
Okay, and then I also haven't heard, but being female, I'm really interested in the female, in the goddess, and the goddess symbolism and imagery, and all of these dates were very important to the goddess and to reconnection to the earth and the progress of the seasons was really important to keeping people healthy.
Right.
And I remember I called you years ago about false evidence appearing real. Fear is when you change information, you can control people.
Right.
You know, that because you control how they perceive what's going on.
Well, we've certainly changed. I mean, if Len Schlein, I wish he hadn't died on us because I would love to have him on the air to have the conversation that I had with him over lunch back a decade ago. He wrote a brilliant book called The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, and it's really worth reading. And I'm guessing it's probably still in print because it's just such a good book. And if it's out of print, you can buy used copies. And in that book, he lays out all this evidence that, for example, in ancient Europe, before, you know, when it was illegal to be literate, when people were not learning how to read before the age of 7, that basically it was the goddess that was the Christian goddess that was worshipped. Everybody was worshipping Mary. There were shrines to Mary.
Right.
There were churches to Mary. It was all about Mary. Jesus was rarely discussed. And then within a generation of the time that Europe became, literacy became widespread in Europe, within a generation of that time, or certainly in that century, suddenly you had, relatively, you know, anthropologically suddenly, you had women being labeled as witches and burned at the stake and hung and, or hanged, and midwives being labeled as witches, and the eruption of patriarchy, which seems to be associated with literacy. And Walter Ong wrote a brilliant book about this also called Oralcy and Literacy, and a fellow by the name of Logan, Robert Logan, I think, wrote another book on this topic. And the argument that Rudolf Steiner made was that if you wait until children are over 7 years old to teach them abstract alphabets, to teach them how to read, that the left part of the brain, the right, that controls the right side of the body, will not take over, and you will not end up with patriarchy. And Sweden is the only country that does that. Sweden is arguably the most peaceful country in the world, so maybe there's an association there. Geralee, we're out of time. Thank you for calling and bringing up a topic that I would love to spend a whole hour on. Coming up tomorrow, it's Brunch with Bernie. America's Senator Bernie Sanders is going to be here taking your calls. Plus, anything goes Friday. Whatever you want to talk about, we'll pick it up. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag your it. Get out there, get active, and occupy something, eh? See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.